Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Now to a story and a man that makes me enormously proud to be an Australian, and it challenges me deeply to live every moment of every day in gratitude for what we have in Australia. This is a story of an Aussie surgeon following in the footsteps of other legendary Aussies, inspired by the care and compassion of their Christian faith, to literally liberate the lives of thousands of African women. These are women who suffer a fistula after an often traumatic, obstructed labour that mostly leave them pariahs in their villages and communities, frequently divorced by their husbands, shunned by their families, so alone. Aussie surgeon Dr. Andrew Browning began working with the legendary Catherine Hamlin, who set up Africa's first fistula hospital in Ethiopia. Andrew has now moved south to Tanzania with the SIM organisation, where he's bringing unimaginable help and hope to so many women. Andrew's story will, I promise, send your spirit soaring while also challenging our comfort zone. Andrew Browning, from Tanzania, welcome to Open House.
Thanks very much, Lee.
It's great to have you with us. Andrew, it's probably worth explaining, first up, what a fistula injury is and how it happens.
A fistula is just a medical term for a hole. You can have a fistula anywhere in the body, between your breathing pipe and your esophagus, between your bowel and the skin. But the fistula that we're talking about is a hole between the birth canal and the bladder, and sometimes the birth canal and the bowel as well. And how it happens is it happens during labour. So wherever you are in the world, in Africa or Australia or Europe, if you go into labour, a woman has a 5% chance of getting into what's called obstructed labour, which simply means the baby's getting stuck during the labour. Either the mother's pelvis is too small, or the baby's head's too big, or the baby's coming out the wrong way. For whatever reason, the baby's getting stuck and not being able to come out. So that's quite easy to diagnose. You can monitor that in labour, and if you've got a midwife monitoring it, she can pick it up quite early, call a doctor, and the doctor can either do an assisted delivery, but most usually a cesarean section, and you have a safe mother and a safe baby. But for the majority of the women in the world, they simply don't have access to medical care during their delivery. For example, where I used to work in Ethiopia, 93% of women in many areas of Ethiopia will deliver at home without any sort of medical attendance at all. And as a result, in some areas of Ethiopia, 1 in 12 women will die during labour in their lifetime. But if they get into obstructed labour, well, there's no way they can get medical help because the nearest hospital might be 3 or 4 days' travel away and they haven't got the money to get there. So they stay in their village and stay in labour. And the lady can be in labour for 3, 4, 5, 7. I've had ladies even up in labour up to 10 days.
Wow.
Often the women can't survive that long labour and she'll die. But if she survives, the child invariably dies inside her. The child simply cannot cope with such a long labour. And it sounds awful, sorry, but after the baby dies inside, the pressure inside the head, around the brain decreases. The skull bones overlap, and they can deliver a stillborn child. They've usually been in labour for 3 or 4 days, and they're very weak, and they lie absolutely exhausted on the floor of the hut just trying to regain strength. But when they do regain strength, they find that they're leaking uncontrollably from the bladder and sometimes the bowel as well. Because they've been in labour so long, the baby's head's been pressed against the bones of the mother's pelvis, and all the tissue between, which is the tissue of the bladder and the birth canal, and sometimes the rectum and the birth canal, has its blood supply cut off, and after they deliver that stillborn child, all that dead tissue comes away. That tissue that has the blood supply cut off dies, and all that dead tissue comes away, and she's left with a fistula, or the hole, between the bladder, outside world, and rectum and the outside world. So every bit of urine that she makes, and sometimes feces as well, leaks out through that hole onto the legs and onto the floor. She's usually terrified by that experience, and she lies very still on the floor of her hut just trying to regain strength and trying, hopefully, that this leakage of urine will stop. But, of course, it never does. Mm. She's very ashamed. The husband often divorces her because he can't have her in the house because she's smelling so bad. She'll live really a life of ostracism, being neglected by her family, friends, been outcast from the community, and she'll live like that for the rest of her life. And it's quite a common thing. We estimate there's up to 3 million women with this condition around the world still waiting for treatment. And every year, we're adding 50 to 100,000 women with this condition to that number.
Wow.
But it's easily prevented. If women had access to safe obstetrics like you do in Australia. And indeed, the world's first fistula hospital was in America, in New York, in 1855, because fistulas were quite common in America back then. But with the advent of safe and available obstetrics for all women, that's been eradicated. But in the developing world, it's been far. The eradication is far from a reality still yet.
Can you tell us more about the isolation, the alienation, the humiliation these women face and experience? Some walk around with bags of perfumed soap around their neck.
Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of different stories, and it actually varies between different countries. In Ethiopia, there's a real stigma to any sort of bad smell, and they're really ostracized. They can't go to the market, they can't socialize with friends, they can't go to the mosque or the church to worship. They really are cut off from society. I'm very privileged now that I'm based in Tanzania, but I go around Africa to help and support fistula units around Africa. And different societies have different levels of care for the women, I suppose. In Tanzania, it's not as bad. You find ladies there, they're ostracized, but they can still sometimes work. They can still sometimes go to the church. They're often still divorced. Some are not. So it varies from country to country. But one country that I have most experience in is Ethiopia. The ostracism there is really quite marked. And when the ladies come to the hospital, if you do psychological screening tests, 100% of them are testing severely positive for depression, and 40% have either thought about or attempted suicide because of that condition.
Andrew, tell us how and why you first got involved in this work.
First, I'm a Christian, then I'm a doctor, and I've always thought and dreamt and believed that I might be a Christian missionary doctor one day. And so I pursued that dream during medical school and went and did my medical elective in Tanzania and fell in love with the work. I was actually involved in the Rwandan genocide back then in refugee camps in Tanzania. But fell in love with the work and really thought that this is a marvelous way to serve God. So when I finished my junior medical years in Gosford Hospital, I went to Ethiopia and helped my aunt. She's a lady who's been in Ethiopia since 1974, taking aid to the Afar people, which is a very neglected nomadic tribe in the desert area of Ethiopia. My father was a gynecologist, and he said, "Oh, you must visit the Fistula Hospital while you're in Ethiopia." So I did, and met Dr. Hamlin. She took me to theatre and operated with her, and she kept on asking me back to her house and to the hospital while I was in Ethiopia at that time. And when I left Ethiopia on that visit, she rang me up and offered me a job. She said, "I'd like you to come back and help me." So I prayed about it for a year, went and studied theology for a year, then answered yes, and then I had to do my obstetrics gynecology training in Australia and England, and then moved to Ethiopia in 2001.
Andrew, for those who don't know much about Catherine Hamlin's story, take us through that briefly, because hers is a remarkable story, isn't it?
Yeah, she's a remarkable lady. I was with her yesterday, actually, in Ethiopia, and she's still going strong, the age of 89. I hope she doesn't mind me saying that on radio.
Sure not.
And so her and her husband was a gynecologist, Reg Hamlin, working in Australia, and she was a doctor, and they got married to each other, and they answered an advert in a medical journal back then of answering a call to start a midwifery school in Ethiopia, and they decided that might be an interesting thing to do. So in 1959, they moved to Ethiopia to start a midwifery school. The government ran out of funds to do that, so that never eventuated. But they just kept continuing work, running the obstetrics and gynecology department in the government hospital in Addis Ababa, the capital of Ethiopia. They noticed the problem of fistula patients. Some fistula patients would come to the hospital in hope of a cure, and previously no one had bothered caring for them. They just were deemed inoperable. But the Hamlins researched the work of a doctor called James Marion Sims, who was an American gynecologist in the 1850s, and he was operating on fistulas back then. And they perfected his techniques and started to operate on these ladies in Ethiopia and started to cure them. And word got around Ethiopia that they could be cured, so the patients started to come to the government hospital where the Hamlins were in greater numbers, and in such great numbers that they couldn't look after them there. There wasn't ward space. They had to build an extra ward because even in the general wards, the other patients wouldn't allow them in because they smelt so bad. Sometimes even the guards at the hospital gates wouldn't let them into the hospital because they said you're smelling too bad, you can't come to the hospital. So they decided to build their own hospital as a haven for these patients and care for them. So they slowly raised the funds over a period of years, and in 1974 they opened the Addis Ababa Fistula Hospital. And since opening that hospital, they've now been responsible for treating and caring for around 40,000 women with this condition in Ethiopia. And Reg died in 1993, and Catherine's continued the work with her team in Ethiopia since then, and she's continuing to this day.
And it's always been a Christian mission.
In Ethiopia, it's not as clear-cut as that. There are some Christian missions. It's very difficult to have a covert Christian hospital in Ethiopia because the government and the Orthodox Church have the power and they don't allow that. So it's been Christian in nature, but it's never been called a Christian mission hospital. No. But in other countries where I work, yes, it's all pretty well done by Christian mission hospitals. So yes, it's a Christian hospital in Addis Ababa, led by Christian principals, but it's run as a charity, as a legal term.
Yes. Can you paint us a picture of where you work and the conditions under which you work day to day, Andrew?
At the moment, I'm in Arusha, Tanzania, which is a lovely town. It's kind of Africa light. It's not not as bad, nearly as bad as other places I've worked. So, yesterday we had no water and electricity goes off a lot, but you can buy food, you can get around town. Things are very comfortable in Arusha in comparison to many other places. Where we were in Bahadar before we came here, that's a town in northern Ethiopia where we set up another fistula hospital. That was a different picture altogether. It was very, very rudimentary, just in the things you could buy. I mean, when we got there, you couldn't buy bread, so you couldn't even buy flour, so you had to go to the market and buy wheat and grind it to make flour to make bread. You couldn't buy meat from a butcher, you had to buy it live and bring it home and slaughter it and things. And even the hospital itself, I mean, we'd regularly be without water and electricity and operating in the dark. You just have to bring the table close to the operating table close to the window to be able to operate. The conditions are very different. I mean, now I'm working all over Africa, Uganda, Sierra Leone, Malawi and things, and the conditions vary immensely between different places. But actually where I am now, in Arusha, Tanzania, it's comparatively... I mean, people that come from Australia to Arusha think, oh, this is a tough place. But if you come from northern Ethiopia to Arusha, you think you're back in Europe or something.
Yes. Andrew, the fistula operation that you carry out for many is relatively short with a pretty impressive success rate.
Some are short, some are long. 15% of cases are simple and they can be operated and cured within 15 minutes, half an hour. But they do become quite difficult quite rapidly. So a difficult operation may take 2 to 3 hours. You might have to make a new urethra, a new birth canal, put bowel back together. But despite that, their success rate is good. I mean, we get a success in closing the fistula and getting the hole closed in 93 to 97% of the operations. But even if the fistula is closed, doesn't necessarily mean that she's cured. She still may have some leaking of urine if she coughs or sneezes or walks or lifts something heavy. Called stress incontinence, and there's secondary procedures we can do to help with that, which has a 70% success rate. So the vast majority of women, we can get cured and back to a normal life.
For those women, as you see them, both before and after, it must be a tremendously gratifying work to be involved in.
Oh, it is. It's absolutely delightful. Yeah, it's one of the few operations you can do that will just completely transform someone's life from someone who's just ashamed and wants to commit suicide. They can't even look at you in the eye to talk to you. To someone who's just happy to be alive again. She can go home, get reunited with her family, even get remarried. They even come back to us pregnant. We have give them a cesarean section. They have a live baby. And that full circle is such an immensely rewarding part of that. And it's interesting too. I mean, talking about faith and working in Christian hospitals, I mean, I was in Malawi working in a government hospital where they're doing fistula repair. And it's kind of an emptiness sometimes when you do that work, but you don't share the love of Christ with them. But, I mean, to make it absolutely complete, you can bring them physical healing, but also some spiritual healing without knowing that God is God that brings this healing to them through the provision of Christian people that just want to reach out to the unloved people of the world.
Yes, how does that impact those women who are impacted by the motivation behind your work?
Yeah, I mean, it's all sorts of different ways. In the hospitals we've been working, we have chaplains, of course, that'll pray for the patients. We always pray with the patients. And if they want to know the reason that we're doing this, the chaplains will certainly explain. And but just the care that's given to them, I mean, we care for all sorts of people, animists or Christians or Muslims. We don't
mind who we treat and care for. That's part of the Christian message, that you love everyone. We had a patient, for example, the other day. She was a Muslim lady. It's been to several hospitals, been operated on many times. She couldn't be cured. And she had an extremely difficult operation. We had to fly in a professor of urology from Ethiopia to help with a very difficult procedure. She was eventually cured. And she just remarked, she said, "Oh, it's really only Christians who's cared for me during all this time. There must be something in Christianity." So yes. Very rewarding. I mean, when she says in John to love not just with words and speech, but with action as well, all goes together to love people and meet their physical needs and also their spiritual needs.
Yes. How many women are being treated each year, and how many do you think need it who are going untreated?
The first figure we know, we got recent figures out, something like 15,000 women were treated last year, which is a tremendous improvement over recent years. Yeah, which is a great encouragement, but we're still way behind the eight ball. There's been variable estimates between 2 million and 3 million people, women still waiting for treatment, mainly across Africa, but also across Southeast Asia. But the real crux of the matter is, I mean, it can be prevented. And really, there's not much prevention work being done on the ground. And so other little organisations, people are trying to do their bit to try and prevent it. But I think that should be the emphasis for the next, my lifetime at least, anyway.
Yes, yes. As with so much else, when you compare the economies of scale in Africa with a country like Australia, the treatment by our measure is so cheap considering the impact on these women.
Oh, yes, very cheap. And again, it varies between hospitals. The most expensive hospital I work in right now, the treatment, the hospital stay, the treatment, new clothes to go home in, transport, even a teaching program for the girls costs $415. And the hospital I'm based in Tanzania, it costs $300 for the same. So 3-week hospital stay, yeah, chaplain coming to speak to them, the whole hospital treatment, food, transport home, yeah, everything. So it's very, very, very cheap. I think that would maybe just get your toe in the door in an Australian hospital.
Yeah, that's right. And the patients are never charged for their care. Who does pay for it?
They're quite impoverished. They can't afford anything. So all that treatment is paid for. The majority of the work is being done by Christian hospitals, mission hospitals around, and it's always a struggle to fundraise. So you, at the moment, I'm getting the funds through Vodacom Foundation to be able to treat them. Sometimes it's been through churches. Sometimes it's been through the UN, the UNFPA, another American NGO called Engender Health. The work that the Hamlets started was pretty well started only by church donations. Yeah, so all different means, but you're just going to become a good beggar and get money wherever you can.
Yes. It's probably worth making the point that a large proportion of healthcare in Africa is done by people involved in Christian mission.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the statistic from Africa as a whole is that 50% of all healthcare, you know, hospital beds, the number of hospital beds and patients being treated is provided by what they call faith-based organisations or mission hospitals. So predominantly the Catholics, 25% of the whole total is just by the Catholic Church alone. And then the remaining 25% to make 50% is Anglicans or other Protestant organisations, providing, you know, good quality, cheap, and often free healthcare to the poorest and most inaccessible places in the world.
How many operations like this do you think you've done in your 12 years as a surgeon?
Yeah, I've done, it's a little over 5,000 now. I've been involved in the care of probably another 3,000 on top of that.
It's a remarkable achievement. When I hear about Catherine Hamlin and the work you do, this is an inescapable question. Here are very capable, highly trained and gifted surgeons who would achieve great success and wealth in a country like Australia. Why don't you do that?
Why don't you? Why would you when you have the opportunity to serve God and help some of the poorest people in the world? I think a question like that raises a few assumptions that one of the purposes in life is to have a comfortable life for yourself. So I don't believe it's true. I think true meaning of life is to serve God and to love God with your whole heart, soul and mind and love others as yourself. There's a great satisfaction and contentment in serving God. Yeah, and there's often an emptiness in materialism. So, yeah, why would you follow materialism when you can follow God?
It's a great answer.
Simple answer.
A great answer. Out of all of those you've treated, is there one particular story you could relate to us that's had a particular impact on you?
I'm often asked that. I mean, there's so many. I can relate to you a horrible story, a girl from Congo who was absolutely a delightful girl. There was a lot of civil war at the time, And we had to, we were waiting to get into Congo, and the border was closed. You had to get into Rwanda, and it was closed. Then all of a sudden it was open. So we flew down from Ethiopia across the border and did a couple of weeks operating, and then the war started again. We had to get out. But during the time, there was a lot of sexual abuse and rape of women, and met some awful, awful cases that really impacted me. For example, one girl who was pregnant and raped by 10 soldiers, cut open, and the baby ripped out in front of her eyes, and then cut in the vagina to cause a fistula. Yeah, she had so much suffering that she'd been through, but found by Christians, brought to a Christian hospital, cured. Find some awful stories of suffering there. Another girl had been, again, raped by, she thinks, about 10 soldiers, then a gun put on her genitalia and shot, and a great fistula formed in her bowel and her bladder. And she was found half dead by, again, Christians brought to us. And but she was so cheerful. And I asked her, you know, how can you possibly be cheerful when you've been through so much suffering? And she said, oh, God's just provided people to care for me the whole way. You know, reflection of, oh, dear, my life is ruined, woe is me. It was just a hope in that, in God has been caring for her. You know, very challenging to your personal faith.
Yes.
Oh, the typical fistula girls. I mean, some of them are so, so lovely. There was a girl from Ethiopia, we'll call her Trunish. Yeah, she had a four-day labor and a first delivery in Ethiopia, absolute agony in the village, and delivered a stillborn child. Got a fistula to her bladder, started leaking urine, and she was really ostracized. She was put in a little hut in the corner of the family compound and later moved to a church where she lived in the edge of the church compound, really in isolation, just fed by the people in the Orthodox Church, by the nuns and the deacons. And she lived like that for 40 years. She hardly went out at all, didn't socialize for 40 years. She was found by one of our outreach people and brought to us in the hospital. She actually had a very, very simple fistula. It was cured in about 10 minutes. But, I mean, she has had such a different life to anything that we comprehend. She'd never seen anything as simple as a tap or held a pencil, anything like that. And when she went to the operating theatre, it was all totally foreign to her, and everything was very new. And she just lay on the operating theatre table, quite anxious, of course, and said, oh, I don't care if I die now because I've slept in a comfortable bed and I've seen an electric light. So her life was now complete. Wow. She'd experienced all that she needed to experience in life. But fortunately, she didn't die. She was cured and certainly went home rejoicing that she could have some years, remaining years, with some dignity.
What amazing stories. Andrew, what of the future? Will this be a problem that can ever be fixed?
Of course it can be fixed. We've fixed it in the West. They used, as I said, the first fistula hospital was in New York and opened in 1855. It closed in the early 1900s because there was no fistulas left in America. And on that site is now the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in Manhattan. Yeah, certainly fistula can be eradicated. But it takes a great deal of effort from governments, from NGOs, from people, personnel. And the way you eradicate it is to have all women have access to safe obstetrics. So with God's blessing, we've been doing our own little bit. And I just came back from Ethiopia this morning and we were opening a new maternity hospital in the northern part of Ethiopia. And yeah, we're providing a cesarean section service, delivery service for free for all women. And it's only just been opened. And just even during my opening speech, there was four women delivering in the room next door, so it's been well used already.
Yes.
So but all that takes a lot of effort and a lot of hard work, and it needs a lot of money, and we're behind in that project. We still need another $350,000 to complete that project. It sounds horrible to say, but fistula has become quite a trendy thing to fund in recent years, and that we could get the money to build a new fistula hospital almost overnight, but to build a maternity hospital to actually prevent fistulas from occurring, it take you years to raise the funds and then to find the staff and to keep it running. So there needs to be a change in people's attitudes towards safe motherhood and women's rights all around the developing world, really.
Yes. If there are people who want to find out more, maybe even help, maybe even take part in some of this work, where should they go for more information, Andrew?
Yeah, we've got two websites. One's called the Barbara May Foundation, which is our fundraising arm for the prevention work of fistula in Australia. So you can just look up www.barbaramayfoundation.com. Our website for work on the ground is maternityafrica.org. Okay. All donations in Australia are tax deductible, of course. And if you want to volunteer, the contacts to be able to be interested in volunteering are also on those websites.
Okay. We'll put the details of both of those websites up on our Open House Community Facebook page. Andrew Browning, you've certainly opened our eyes. You've broadened our horizons. and also the concept of what it means to be Christian. I'm so grateful for your time. Thank you so much indeed for joining us on Open House.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Lee. Thanks very much.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.